Last month, WKAR-TV Capitol correspondent and off-the-record host Tim Skubick welcomed the senior U.S. Senator from Michigan, Carl Levin. On the eve of his retirement, Senator Levin discusses what sparked his interest in politics, lessons learned from nearly four decades in the Senate, his post-Senate plans, and much, much more. Here's Tim and Senator Levin.
Let's start with an easy question.
Yeah, right.
You don't believe me, do you? What did you want to be when you were growing up?
Tim Skubick.
No, you didn't.
I wanted to be a TV. How old was I that you're referring to?
Well,
like 3, 10, 15?
You know.
Probably something in athletics.
You wanted to be what, baseball?
No, probably hockey.
Hockey?
Basketball.
Basketball?
Yeah,
that one I can't believe.
I played basketball in college.
When did you decide that you couldn't play?
I didn't decide. The coach decided, actually. I did play varsity ball in that little school I went to, which is probably one of the reasons I went to the school, because I could make the varsity team. Swarthmore College in Swarthmore, Pennsylvania, a little Quaker school, and I fell in love with it. And I played basketball until I broke my knee. And
the rest is history. The NBA never called.
Well, probably
so
never would have
made
it.
When did you get the calling? When did you get the bug for public service, and where did that come from?
Well, the bug for it actually would have come from my dad and my mother. My dad was a strong supporter of FDR. Sandy and I, my brother, and I and our sister used to, at the dinner table every night, talk politics with my dad and my mother. And he used to listen to some of the radio programs that had the guys who were far right wingers out there, like Fulton Lewis Jr. And my dad was a liberal. We used to call ourselves Midwest progressives. But my dad used to listen to people, to the radio shows that used to drive him crazy, just so he'd know what they're saying. He wants to know what the enemy was up to. So he was into politics himself. He never ran for office. My dad was on the Corrections Commission in Michigan. Had been appointed by Soapy Williams to the Corrections Commission, and that was a citizen's position, not paying position. Mm-hmm. So he and my uncle was a federal judge, had been appointed.
Well, did they sit you down and say, you have no choice, you have to be involved?
No.
They gave you
the last thing in the world of our parents was to say, you have no choice. They would never do that. As a matter of fact, our parents said, do whatever you want to do, but be happy. Do something you love to do. It doesn't make any difference. You make a lot of money. You got to be happy. My dad was a lawyer. But he never was happy as a lawyer, as it turned out. He told us late in his life that he really wanted to be a doctor, as one of his brothers was. And so he always told us, don't do what someone tells you you ought to do. Do what you think will make you the happiest.
Were you happy as a taxi driver?
Yeah. My brother and I had a great competition.
Competed for summers. Fares? What did you do?
No, we competed. We competed to see who would take in more money during the day. And I used to get bigger tips because people used to look at me and I was very young and they felt like they ought to give this young guy a tip. My brother was a faster, better driver, so he had longer and he had more fares. I had more tips.
And you ran for city council. Who urged you to do that?
I don't remember. Probably some leaders in Detroit at the time.
How did they find you, driving cab?
No, I was, by that time, I was head of the, or I wasn't head of, I was the, I had helped to found the Defender's Office in Detroit, which represents indigents, and the city and the state did not have an office to represent indigents accused of crime or convicted of crime. And so we founded the Bar Association in Detroit, created this new Legal Aid and Defender's Office in Detroit, and I was head of the Appellate Division. And that's what I was doing when the riot came in 1967. And so I was in the Defender's Office. I was fairly well known in the city and across racial lines. I was fairly well known. My cousin had run for judge by then. So
everybody knew the Levins.
Everyone knew the name. It was a good name. And so that's really what propelled me to run was leaders in the white and black communities in Detroit thought I could help to heal the city after the riot. And that's when I decided to run for city council.
And the idea to run for the U.S. Senate? Pretty big jump.
Yeah, big jump. At the end of my second term, probably it was two or three people, my wife, Leon Cohan, who was Frank Kelly's deputy, urged me to run. Judd Arnett, who was a Free Press reporter.
Did you want to?
Oh, yeah. By then, I'd wanted to run. I wouldn't do it unless I had wanted to run. And there was, I think, Lou Gordon, as a matter of fact.
Lou Gordon,
yeah.
Called you up and said...
No, he didn't call me. He said some nice things on the air about the...
I thought you didn't watch television.
Television?
Well, television news.
Oh, no, the news I never watched. No. but you might be on it, that's why.
Yeah, I understand. But Lou Gordon said nice things about you, and based on that, you decided to get in the race.
Judd Arnett said some nice things in the Free Press, as a matter of fact, and Leon, who is a real pro, Frank Kelly's number one deputy, urged me too.
When you sat down with your wife, because Barbara's been a close confidant,
right.
Did she say, I really want you to do this, or, like your parents, it's your choice?
Yeah. No, she said, I'll support you if you do it.
But she didn't?
No, she's never been pushy.
Yeah.
And for anything. I've been blessed 53 years of marriage now. So I've been lucky in love and lucky in politics and lucky in health. I'm a lucky guy.
Did she tell you it was time to retire?
Now?
Mm-hmm.
No. She said we talked about it a long time and felt it was the right thing to do for a number of reasons. But we reached the same decision that I should retire.
You thought a couple of times about retiring other than this time, didn't you?
I don't think so, but if you got it on the record that I did, I'm not going to fight.
Well,
I
do not have it on the record, but I know that you went back and forth before this last term. But am I reading that wrong?
I don't remember that. It's possible.
Did you wake up and say, okay, now it's time?
No, I think actually the last time probably would have been, would have been in 2008. So Obama would have been running that time. I think probably that was part of the decision, is we thought that coming off the Bush administration that I ought to...
You ought to hang around.
Right.
So did you wake up one day and say, okay, I'm ready to pack it in?
This time?
Mm-hmm.
No. But Barbara and I spent a lot of time.
How long did you take?
Months.
Thinking, really?
Oh, yeah.
Why so long?
It's a tough decision.
Why?
I love my work.
Yeah.
And by the way, I better quickly say, in case Barbara's watching this show, that one of the people who had urged me to run at least for the Senate, now you were asking about city council, but Senate was Barbara. And so the people that I was referring to were people who urged me to run for the Senate, and I may have gotten the question mixed up.
No, I think that was all right. Oh, yeah. Well, did you waver back and forth? Would you wake up one morning and say, oh, yeah, I'm going to go? The next morning say, no, I got to stay?
No, we didn't. We were just thinking it through. We weren't going back and forth. We were just thinking about the pros and cons.
And what were the cons?
Against running for again, you mean?
Mm-hmm.
A number of things. One, this decision was made about 2 years ago. And so we had to look at how I want to spend the next 2 years, basically.
That's how come we didn't announce it then?
Because we hadn't decided then.
Well, you said the decision was made 2 years ago.
We had to start making the decision, thinking through whether to run about 2 years ago. And the question for me and Barb was how I wanted to spend the next 2 years, and I was 78 years old, and there's a number of factors. Probably the most important is that I have a lot of responsibility. I'm chairman of the Armed Services Committee, so I do a lot of traveling to Afghanistan and Iraq and to other places. I didn't want to be out running for re-election while I had that responsibility. Secondly, I didn't see myself out raising money during this period
you
of time.
Hated that.
I hate raising money, and I also thought I just didn't want to be doing that instead of two things, which I've been focusing on this last 2 years. One are the wars, but secondly is my responsibility as chairman of the Permanent Subcommittee on Investigations, going after some of the real abuses on Wall Street, some of the tax avoidance schemes which are used by the most profitable corporations to avoid paying taxes.
You're not fond of the boys on Wall Street, are you?
Well, I don't want to generalize. Some of them I'm fond of, and others I think are overly greedy and do things that are immoral.
So you decided then on the plus side, you could have a life.
plus side, you mean in terms of retiring now?
Yeah.
The cons were why retire, and now you're giving me the pluses for why retire. And so it's, you know, there's some excitement if you're in good health, that you could at the age of 80 start something new. And that wouldn't be true 6 years from now if I ran and won. It'd be 86. That was sort of a frightening prospect, too. I'd seen too many people in the Senate stay too long, and I didn't want to do that either. So the idea that I'd be 86 at the end of my next term if I were reelected was a little bit scary to me.
Senior U.S. Senator from Michigan Carl Levin with WKAR-TV Capitol correspondent and off-the-record host Tim Skubick. You're listening to a November 2014 discussion with Tim and Senator Levin about his nearly four decades in the Senate, his post-Senate plans, and more.
So you're going to write a book?
I don't think so. I'm doing a history, oral history, with the Senate historian, but I have no plans to write a book.
Why not? You have a story to tell.
Yeah, I have
taxi
a lot of...
Taxi driver becomes U.S. Senator, huh? There's the headline.
Yeah, now I have a lot of stories to tell. I'm not sure how interesting they'll be and
oh,
how...
Oh, goodness, Senator.
Well, I don't know. It's hard for me to imagine that, except for my kids and grandkids and family and you know, a lot, there'll be some other people, obviously, but it's kind of hard to imagine a book. It's anecdotes. I have 100 anecdotes, but together, maybe 1,000 anecdotes, but I don't think that together is a book.
Well, let's start with this one. Which president were you the closest to?
Probably Clinton.
Was that by accident?
No, I think it's by his temperament, my temperament, his reaching out to the Congress.
What kind of relationship do you have with the current president?
Good. He's not a reaching out kind of a guy, so I don't see as much of him as
like
I did of the president.
But he doesn't
like President Clinton.
Mr. Clinton loved to play the game.
He did.
And Mr. Obama does not.
That's basically, I think, that he's a much more cautious, less of an outreacher than Clinton was. Clinton was more than just a backslapper, which of course he is too. I mean, if you talk to Clinton, you know, you think, my God, there's nobody else in his conversation or in looking around the room. It's just you and the president. And he's got a wonderful knack, a memory, a wonderful little history with my father-in-law, who was 100 years old, and went to the White House. And the memory that Bill Clinton would have about people's stories was really amazing.
So this current president, to a fault, he has not been engaged, yes?
No, I'd say he's been engaged, but probably not adequately engaged.
Well, if he's not adequately engaged, that would be a fault, wouldn't it?
The way you phrase it would be more extreme than I would.
Well, how would you phrase it?
That he was not adequately involved, just the way I phrased it.
Right, but in all seriousness,
yeah.
He doesn't want to get in and get his hands dirty and get stuff done.
Oh, he wants to get stuff done. Believe me, he wants to get stuff done.
But he doesn't
done.
Want to get his hands dirty.
No, it's not dirty. I think he thinks that the way he gets things done is through not just his leadership, but also through the leaders of Congress being able to get the job done. And secondly, it's a matter of time. He's very, very intellectual. He's very thoughtful. He reads a lot. And so I think he puts that kind of studying and weighing pros and cons ahead of taking the time to sit down with people and spend time talking about issues.
But one of the lessons you learned in the U.S. Senate, it is based on trust and human relationships,
sir. It's very much so.
And if you take that out of the equation, you're toast.
Well, he didn't take it out of the equation. It's a matter, again, of degree and adequacy.
Did you play that game pretty well?
Others are going to judge that. I'm not going to judge myself.
Well, did you trust other people?
Yeah.
Did you trust John McCain?
Yes.
Who didn't you trust in the Senate?
Yeah, I'm not going there.
We were doing so
read my
well.
Book that I'm not writing.
We were doing so well. Well, there were people that you judged that you couldn't trust,
right,
without naming
sure.
names. What did you learn in the Senate about yourself?
That when you start something new, you're intimidated, and that you just have to grit your teeth and realize that everybody else that starts a job that's a bit overwhelming, which the U.S. Senate is, just has to realize that everybody else who started that job probably was overwhelmed too, and just you'll see it through.
You were intimidated when you walked into the U.S.
Sure,
Senate?
Sure, of course I was. Most people are.
What did that feel like?
A little bit scary.
Why?
Because it's an intimidating place. You look up at all those pictures and you see pictures of, you know, Daniel Webster, and you see Lyndon LBJ, who's the majority leader, and you look around at the people in there. You look at Kennedy sitting in there, and you look at McGovern, who's in the Senate. You look at Muskie, who's in the Senate. You know, these people were there when I got there, and it's an intimidating thing. These are people who are presidential candidates, there, you know, Scoop Jackson was there when I got there.
You supported him for president?
No, I didn't.
You didn't? Yeah. Why not?
I don't remember, but I can't remember all the reasons of who I picked at that time. I can't remember even for sure what year he ran. He probably ran in 60. He probably ran against, I don't know, LBJ maybe in 64.
So how long did it take you to become unintimidated?
A long time. I'd say probably 5-10 years.
5 to 10 years? Yeah. That was a long time to be intimidated.
Yeah. It's an intimidating place.
That's an unusual word. I mean, they say it's the best debating decide. What's the downside of serving in the Senate?
I can't think of many. It's a fabulous job. It's a fabulous place. You know, the people read of all the gridlock, and there's much too much of it. But it's still a great place to work. And so it's you have a huge staff that can help you. Great staff back home in Michigan that can help you. We work with people here, which is one of the most rewarding things, by the way, of service. It's not just legislation you get involved in. That's sort of the stuff you read about. What you don't read about so much, understandably, is the literally thousands of people, probably over 36 years, who my staff and I have been able to help.
Mr. Snowden, a traitor?
I think he's... I don't have any love for him. I don't admire him. I would have admired him if he had come home and stood for what he believed and said, "Okay, take me to court. If you want to take me to court, but I did the right thing." I'm not so sure juries would have convicted him, but if he had the kind of courage that I respect, it wouldn't just be stealing stuff and releasing it to the media. It would have been, if he wanted to release it to the media, if he thought that was his obligation as a citizen, do it here and stand up for what he believed and take his medicine, if it is medicine. I mean, I'm not sure a jury would have convicted him. Reminds me of the old times. You may remember back in Detroit when I was city council president, we were trying to rip down these vacant houses, a lot of them owned by the federal government, HUD, and I said,
we sent the bulldozers in.
Yeah, we sent the bulldozers in, and they said they were going to indict me if I touched federal property. And I said, "Are you kidding? You're going to indict me for tearing down a nuisance in our neighborhoods? Go ahead. The jury's going to convict you, HUD. They're not going to convict me." It sort of reminds me of that. I mean, it reminds me of the sit-ins in the South. You know, people sat in, they violated the law, Rosa Parks being the prime example. She violated the law and decided, "Okay, go ahead, try me." But that's not what Snowden did.
Well, he made a judgment that he thought he was doing the right thing. It was sort of like with your parents. Do whatever you do, what you think is right, right, and go forward.
No, but be accountable, take responsibility. And if you think that the law is wrong, test the law, don't run away.
Do you believe the Republicans conspired against this president to make sure he had some more failures than successes?
I think the Republicans have, I don't use the word conspire because that's a legal term which I wouldn't use. I think they have come together to give him a very hard time on everything.
How about connive?
I think they've come together. It may not even be conscious. It may even be subconscious. I don't know if they got together in a room and say, "Let's oppose everything that he does." I think that their political instincts, which are way off base, I think, in this regard, were to make this president fail. As a matter of fact, Mitch McConnell, the first day, I guess, of this last Congress, or maybe the Congress before, said that his goal in Congress is to defeat the president for his reelection. So it would have been 4 years ago then, I guess. I mean, for a leader of the Republican Party to get on the floor of the Senate and to talk about a goal to defeat the president in a reelection is really, to me, so far below what leadership should be. They ought to help a president succeed, if they can, by a legislative record, which is good for the American people. And if that leads to a plus for the president, so be it. I mean, I've heard Republicans in the Senate most of the time I've been there say that even though it was a Democratic president at times, that's our president. And now that he's elected, they didn't support him. We're going to try to help him succeed. I've heard Republicans say that and mean that. I heard Bob Dole say that and mean that.
But those days are gone, Senator.
And they're gone, I hope, for the moment. Howard Baker said that and believed that. And to me, it's really kind of a low blow to our country for the Republicans, for whatever political instincts have driven them to make this president fail. And whenever the president supports something, they oppose it on almost everything.
Does that bug you?
Yeah, it should bug the people, but apparently so far hasn't. I think history will show that he is a good president, maybe not a great one, but a good president. A president, particularly in the area of foreign relations, interestingly enough, he's done very, very well with a couple wars that he inherited, and he's done in Afghanistan, he did the right thing. In Iraq, I think he had no alternative because, believe it or not, Bush set the date for removal of our troops. People forget that. Republicans say President Obama took our troops out of Iraq. No, he didn't. President Bush set the date for the removal of our troops from Iraq, and this president stood with that because he couldn't get the Iraqi parliament to decide that they wanted to keep some American troops. Afghanistan, the American people think we failed in Afghanistan. I've been there a dozen times. We have had, it's a glass more than half full in Afghanistan, and it's getting fuller. But the media depiction of Afghanistan has been so consistently negative that American people don't realize the dramatic changes that have taken place. I mean, what they'll read about, understandably, is a bombing just the other day, 30 kids at a soccer game blown up by the Taliban. They read that. It's news, obviously. It should be covered. But they don't hear, see, or read about is the successes in Afghanistan. The tens of millions of kids that are now in school, 40% of them girls. No girls went to school under the Taliban. Teachers now, a significant percentage of teachers, like 40%, are women. Healthcare is totally better. The economy is not humming. It's a very poor country. It is far, far better than it was under the Taliban. And so it's too bad. It's really too bad that the American people don't have that sense of success to which we should feel when we've been to war, and our troops and their families. Troops put their lives on the line, and I think they've seen changes for the most part that are positive, but the American people don't have that sense of success that I think they should sense and feel.
Will you support Ms. Clinton for president?
I haven't decided to support.
You're leaning?
Well, she'd be, I think, a terrific president, but I don't know who the candidates are yet.
Well, do you need any others if she's the one?
If she's the one, no, I wouldn't need any others.
Do you think there will be others?
Probably not, but I want to wait and see.
Why would you want to wait?
Because I'd like to see what the alternatives are before I run. Before I decide, that's kind of my nature, is I like to see what the options are before I choose. I think she'd be a terrific president. I could obviously support her 1,000%, but I have colleagues who are thinking of running, maybe, or talked about as running. I just kind of, almost out of respect for colleagues, would wait and see what if anyone else announces.
What's your legacy?
You know, I still, believe it or not, I'm looking forward to getting my defense bill passed. That's my next job, and so there'll be plenty of time, I hope, to be in good health that I can look back. But I'm not starting yet. The show, I know, is it's tempting to look back, particularly sitting with you, because you and I go back so far to look backwards, but I'm going to resist temptation.
Do you wish you had practiced the piano more?
No, the world's a lot better off because I didn't practice the piano. As a matter of fact, I wish I did play the piano. My wife is a terrific piano player, and I listen to her playing Chopin and Brahms almost every day.
Senator, it's been an honor to cover you, sir.
Thank you, Tim.
Have fun.
Well, I intend to have a lot of that with my kids and grandkids and wife. And I won't miss you because I know you're going to invite me back on the show at least once a year, right?
Absolutely. You have a standing invite, sir. Good to see you. Thanks for showing up. I appreciate it, sir.
Thank you.
That was WKAR Capitol correspondent and off-the-record host Tim Skubick with the senior U.S. Senator from Michigan, Carl Levin. Senator Levin recorded that interview in the WKAR studios in November 2014, discussing his half-century in public service.